another minute or so. Okay. I saw the chat and I just want to check in with Ksenia and Katarina. You're both saying that you were struggling. So if you want to wait until the end, you can wait to talk about it, or you can tell me now what's going on if you want to, if it would feel better to like have a question answered or something before we move on.
Yeah, I'll go. Sorry, I've got my camera off because my
You're fine.
connection's a bit funny. Yeah, I guess I'm confusing, perhaps I'm confusing emotional scars with more physical symptoms, although as I've learned, the two are often quite intertwined. But I had like a really visceral reaction when you were saying, what if I didn't have to fix or control my, insert problem here? And I was thinking health anxiety is the main one that's coming up for me. But I still have this overwhelming belief that no, this thing is really controlling your life, or and has been, and you absolutely do need to fix it. And the thought of softening around it and not needing to completely heal it, just needing to meet myself there, I don't know, it doesn't appeal as much as I thought it would. There is still this little determined warrior in me that's like, no, we're gonna permanently get rid of all this.
Yeah, that's okay that that's there.
Okay.
It's okay that that's there.
We don't need to fix that
No, we don't.
Okay.
We don't need to fix that either. Katarina, are you feeling similarly?
Yeah, what came up for me is I also deal with chronic pain, so that is what came on my mind, and to surrender to that or just like feel it. Is very difficult, but because in the moment I have these sensations, it's like, okay, I have to do something about it because it's so uncomfortable and so painful. And yeah, so there was resistance. Yeah, a lot of resistance.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. It's great that you can both notice that resistance and sort of notice the little warrior inside that wants to just keep trucking on and keep fixing and healing and all that. Like, it's great that you can notice that. I think here in the second half, I'm going to dive into the energy differences between fixing and supporting. So that might actually make that feel like more clear to you because it's not actually a black and white. It's not like, oh, I'm just totally letting go and accepting. So that means I'm just not doing anything about it. Like, that's not what I mean. If that's where your brain is going, I really think that's just like a protective part that's like, oh, you can't listen to this because I need certainty. I need to fix it. I need to heal it. Maybe it would help you to know that like I also have chronic pain. And have done every modality that I know of to help it. I mean, I've tried chiropractic, I've tried Rolfing, I've tried osteopathy, I've tried massage therapy, I've tried physical therapy, I've rested it, I've worked it, I've tried foam rolling it, I've tried using a ball on it, like I've stretched it, I've not stretched it, I've tried all kinds of things and like it has occurred to me, what if I have to live with this for the rest of my life? Could I still be okay? And I don't like the thought of living with it for the rest of my life. Like I truly do believe that when we give the body what it needs, the body heals. Like I really do believe that. I have so much trust in my body to like do what she needs to do to protect me and let me know if there's a problem. But I've actually gotten to the point where I'm like, I'm not going to stop supporting myself to try to feel better. But I can also accept that this may be something that I feel for the rest of my life. And I've been feeling it on a daily basis for like 5 years, and I'm still alive, and I'm okay. And I still have a really rich, full life. And like, Yeah, there's certain things that I don't do because I know it's going to flare the pain up. But like, none of those things are things that I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm missing out on my whole life. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I think maybe when we get into the energy of fixing versus supporting, that might feel, because like for me, my chronic pain is from hypermobility. So like, I don't stand straight. Like my body is like twisted. My pelvis is twisted. My shoulders are uneven. Like, yeah, there's like some weird space issues happening in my body, and it's all from hypermobility. And like, I'm never going to not be hypermobile. You know, it's never going to happen. Like, I'm in a hypermobile body. I've been in a hypermobile body my whole life. When I was young, it benefited me because it made me really flexible and it made me be able to do things like ballet and leg holds and splits and all these kinds of things. And as I get older and I'm not doing all of those things anymore, now the hypermobility causes pain. You know? So this is what's happening. And of course, I want to support my body because I don't want to be in pain. And I know that pain is a messenger to let me know that my body's like, hey, something's wrong. Right? Like something doesn't feel right, and I gotta let you know. But at the same time, it's like I can be present with that discomfort and be like, okay, this is what's happening. Like I can do some physical therapy right now if that would feel supportive. I could get a massage right now if that feels supportive. But at the end of the day, nothing has ever gotten rid of the pain so far, you know? And I know that that might sound hopeless to a lot of you, but there's actually peace. And accepting like that I'm in a human body that's going to break down more and more as I get older. And of course, I want to support myself to be as healthy as possible, but there's also things that are going to happen that are totally beyond my control that I can't prevent. And I'm not a failure just because I don't prevent those things or because I don't fix whatever I'm experiencing, you know? And it's okay if you're having a really hard time like relaxing into that right now. That's really okay. All right, now we will go into talking about acceptance. Eye rolls across the whole room. All right, our friend Pete Walker says it is exceedingly difficult to accept the proposition, the fact that recovery is never complete. Although we can expect our flashbacks to markedly decrease over time, it is tremendously difficult and sometimes impossible. To let go of the salvation fantasy that we will one day be forever free of them. Yet, when we do not loosen our grip on the salvation fantasy, we remain extremely susceptible to blaming ourselves every time we have a flashback or a symptom or a flare or a whatever. Understanding this is crucial because recovery typically progresses in a process that has many temporary regressions. Moreover, most recoveries often have the unfortunate subjective experience that the temporary regression feels as permanent as concrete. So, how can we come to bear the knowledge that our awful childhoods have created some permanent damage? It helps to see complex PTSD as somewhat analogous to a condition that will need management throughout my life. Complex PTSD can become infrequently bothersome, and even more importantly, we can evolve towards leading increasingly rich and rewarding lives. So, when we aren't accepting what is, we are in resistance, and resistance creates suffering. I don't know who said that first, but I think everyone knows that resistance creates suffering. We can actually end our own suffering through radical acceptance of exactly what's happening. My friend Mark says all the time, this is what's happening. It's like a funny joke in our circle, but it's also like a reminder, like, for all of us to acknowledge, oh yeah, this is what's happening. So for Ksenia and Katarina and anyone else, like you have chronic pain. This is what's happening. I have chronic pain. This is what's happening. I don't have to like it. But if I don't accept it, then I'm going to actually make myself suffer more. This is what's happening. I have massive abandonment scars. I don't know that I'll ever get to a point where I'm not triggered or where I don't go off and get lost in hypervigilance or feel extreme social anxiety whenever I'm too much, whatever the fuck that means. Like, but this is what's happening. Can you allow some space in your body for that? Like for me, I just had to check in with my body and I was clenching my pelvic floor. So like I just like relaxed that and like felt everything drop down. So is there some place in your body that's like putting up a shield or a layer of protection or some guarding or bracing around acceptance? Like this is what's happening. And if there is, like see if you can find that resistance in your body and soften it. Release it. If you're sucking in your belly, like let it go. Drop your pelvic floor. Just feel everything. It's okay if you can't access that right now, too. So here's what acceptance doesn't mean. Acceptance doesn't mean that you're giving up or that you're quitting or that you're going back to sleep and living without awareness again. Or remaining in victim consciousness, or that you stop feeling whatever it is that you're feeling. None of those things are what I'm talking about when I say acceptance. Acceptance does mean presence with whatever is happening in each moment, whether you're triggered, okay, or somewhere in between. Like I can be present in this moment regardless of what I'm feeling. Acceptance means not trying to force or control things that you can't control. It also means reminding ourselves that recovery is a lifelong process and temporary setbacks are part of that process, and they don't have to mean anything about us other than the meaning that you give them. I also believe that grief plays a huge, huge role in acceptance. Grief is a non-negotiable part of coming to acceptance and also authenticity. We have to grieve the loss of our childhood, the loss of our authenticity. The struggles we have now, physical struggles, emotional struggles, mental struggles, financial struggles, whatever those struggles are. We have to grieve over the scars. Do you know how much I have cried over how unfair it is that I have this fucking thing in my body that's like energetic, but affects my life in such big ways sometimes? We have to grieve for what was, for what wasn't, for what could have been. For not having the parents you deserved, for lost time, energy, and money trying to heal something you didn't choose, lost opportunities and relationships, grieving for the ways that you have unconsciously hurt other people, whatever loneliness you might feel now, all of these things are worth grieving. It's valid, it's necessary. People that have a hard time with grief or have problems with grief usually are like, well, I'm not a victim. You know, I don't want to be stuck in victimhood or whatever. It's like, well, no, you don't want to be stuck there, but like you have to acknowledge that you were once a victim. That actually did happen to you. It's okay to grieve that. That doesn't make you a victim. And in fact, you will come out of your victim consciousness a lot fucking faster when you start holding space for the victim part of you instead of being like, oh, shut up, don't be a victim. And when you grieve, it is 100% okay to feel like a victim. This is called compassionate grief. It acknowledges I was in this thing. I was powerless to control it. I didn't have a choice. I did the best I could to survive. That's fucking sad. And that compassionate grief will bring you out of a victim consciousness because the victim part is finally acknowledged and met. You don't have to be in resistance to being a victim. You also don't have to like live your life like a victim. You just have to be with the victim part of you and acknowledge that it's there. So, to grieve what we didn't receive, if you didn't have parents who were interested in you or who answered your questions or told you stories and read you books, who didn't acknowledge your worth or make you feel worthy, who didn't give you fun, joyful experiences, who didn't teach you how to integrate painful experiences, who didn't nurture your creativity or self-expression, who didn't welcome your emotional expression. All of that is so painful and worth grieving over. All of that meant you were a victim. Grieving that you didn't have parents who modeled repair to you or who modeled conscious emotional expression or integrated emotion or who could teach you how to safely feel and release anger. Who didn't give you ample love and warmth, who told you not to cry, who told you not to feel, who shamed you, who didn't make sure you got plenty of sleep and nourishing foods, who didn't help you develop healthy personal habits and self-care. So I use something called imagined reprocessing. I'm sure this probably has another formal name in like the therapy world, but I haven't ever done this in therapy. I've only ever done this in like a somatic coaching context. Something that I unlocked on my own organically and just kind of went with it. I call it imagined reprocessing. So if you would like to do this with yourself, this is massive trauma release and integration work. And you may need some space holding around it. And if you do, that's okay. Like normally people do. So you can start by playing a movie in your imagination of you as a young child, baby, toddler. And in the video, you see yourself as this like beautiful child who is worthy of unconditional love and compassion and respect, who is worthy of being her authentic self. And then you allow yourself to imagine that little girl, that little kid, that little teenager inside of you not receiving the love that she needed, being met with scorn and contempt, not being properly cared for, not being held, not being seen or heard, people pleasing, fawning, stifling your own emotional expression to stay acceptable. And as you play that movie, you can just allow emotion to come up. And maybe what you feel first is actually anger. That's really common. But I promise you, there's also grief there. So you're witnessing this small version of you. It's okay to feel angry. It's okay to feel sad. It's okay to cry. If you have the ability to bring your body online and complete some movements that you weren't able to complete when you were a small child, that's an excellent way to close trauma loops. What I mean by that is like, this is graphic, but it's real. In 2017, I did mushrooms for the first time. I took 5 grams of mushrooms, maybe six. It's a really big dose of mushrooms. And went out in the woods with my friend Honor and David. We were all on mushrooms together, tripping. And that day, my friend Honor had a dagger in a sheath on her belt. And like the dagger became like a symbolic thing that day. If you've never done psychedelics, this might sound really ridiculous to you. If you ever have, then you understand that like little things have meaning and significance throughout the journey. But the dagger, like, would it kind of became a symbolic talking stick, and we kind of ended up taking turns with it. It was like whoever had the dagger, you know, like I have a selenite dagger right here. So I'll just pretend this was the dagger from the trip. Like whoever was holding the dagger would like sometimes just like get it and wave it around in the air and like gesticulate wildly and like proclaim something or like say something meaningful or just scream or something like that and just release. It's great. Well, then towards the end, like it was starting to get dark and we were hiking and we hiked back to her house through the woods. And I had the dagger and I was like, I want to lead the way with the dagger. So I'm like, you know, leading the way and like marching back to her house or whatever through the snow. And to get back up into my friend's yard out of the woods, there's like a, I don't know, like a 20-foot hill maybe that you kind of have to climb up to get back up into her yard. And so I decided to charge the hill with my dagger and I was going to run up it. So I like run up the hill and I'm like, like running up the hill. As soon as I got to the top of the hill, I was totally out of breath. I collapsed to my knees. And as soon as I hit the ground, an image of my stepfather's face flashed into my head out of nowhere. And I already had this dagger in my hand. And I took the dagger and I'm like on my hands and knees. And I started stabbing the snow. And I was imagining that I was stabbing his face. Like, and I was screaming and stabbing and just going at it. And then I started crying. And my friend came up and put her hand on me. And then I suddenly was like, am I a bad person? Because I'm like imagining that I'm stabbing his face. Is this bad? Does this make me bad? And she was like, dude, no, like, you clearly needed to do this. And your body found a way. And I shit you not, my stepfather didn't come up again after that. Really. I've been in EMDR therapy for like a year at this point, unpacking my dad. And that one spontaneous psychedelic assisted imagined reprocessing session was like the resolution that my body needed. So that's what I mean by completing motions that we couldn't complete back then. If I had had the fucking capability, the strength, the access, I would have done that to my stepfather. He was a really bad person. He did a lot of really fucked up shit. And I couldn't complete those movements when I was a child because I had to adapt to survive. I didn't have access to a fight. I didn't have access to be able to run away, right? Because I needed them to survive. So we go back in time and we close some of these loops by completing movements now that we couldn't complete then to give the body a place to send that energy. We can't skip past this part. It's ugly. There's a lot of snot, but it's so necessary. We have to go back and we have to feel what we couldn't feel then because we had to adapt. And I'm not saying you have to do this with every single fucking memory you have. Like, no, I'm not about like, oh, let's go re-traumatize ourselves and remember everything. Like, no. But there are some big ones and you know what they are for you. And you can use this tool. When you work with your kids on the bus, you can use this same process. So I've talked, I think, multiple times about how I believe that our imagination is a portal to healing. Visualization is a huge tool for me. It's a powerful way to hack into the subconscious parts of the brain and resolve trauma looping. It can even reduce or heal triggers because you finally go back and process what went undigested and unmetabolized. And as grief comes up, just feel it. Let it go. It's going to feel better if you let it come up and out, I promise. You will, if, even if it is uncomfortable, you will trade a very short temporary period of discomfort for like very lasting, not relief, but resolution, like for real. So I invite you to be open to the possibility that you could accept yourself and your scars just as you are today. Even if you don't do a shred more healing, you are still worthy, you still belong, and you are still wanted. So now let's talk about safe relationships, because that's a huge piece of this. All of us have been hurt in relationship. All of our fucking childhood trauma comes from relationships. So we have to heal in relationship. And not having safe reciprocal relationships and community is a huge source of lifestyle inflammation because you are a pack animal. Of course, there is a place for self-work. It is important to sit with ourselves and our thoughts and our feelings. And it's important to notice our stories in our head and the voices and be curious. Like all of that is so important. And also, relationships are containers that will bring awareness to our adaptations and coping mechanisms too, because there are certain major adaptations that do not come out in relationship with ourselves, but get poked in relationships with other people. So if you're on this journey and you're like, oh, I have to heal before I can get into a relationship, that is avoidance because you have things about you that are never going to be triggered as long as you're not in intimate relationships. And I don't just mean like romantic relationships. I just mean like intimate platonic friendships. So you can read all the books and listen to all the podcasts and hire all the coaches and take all the courses and do all the breath work and the self work that you want. But in the absence of relationships, you will have no opportunities to work through certain triggers, especially those around abandonment, being too much, feeling unworthy to receive love and nurturing, avoidance of physical or emotional intimacy, being seen, all of that. Only relationship can provide that for you. So here are some qualities of safe relationships. They have mutual respect. There is emotional vulnerability and intimacy. We listen to understand, not to respond. We have open, honest communication. There is space for each person to get dysregulated or triggered without fear of abandonment. These relationships are cooperative, not competitive. They are reciprocal, not transactional. Fun is a big part of it. There is a clear repair process after a rupture or conflict. There is an energy of interdependence. It's not overly codependent. It's not hyper independent. There is validation of feelings and the open invitation to ask if feelings are based in fact or in story. Each person accepts personal responsibility. There's space for each person's perspective. Each person's uniqueness is loved and honored. There are no standards of perfectionism. There's no gaslighting. There's no manipulation. In safe reciprocal relationships, there's no expectation of perfection. Mistakes are allowed. Getting triggered is allowed. So I have to heal before I can be in a relationship with anyone is a bunch of toxic bullshit. That's not real. That belief literally means I am too much. My scars are too much. I am not worthy of reciprocal love, respect, and compassion if I am not healed, meaning if I don't totally fix this thing about myself. So, with this reasoning, none of us would ever be worthy of relationship. And that's just not true. So, this brings us back to acceptance of scars. Where did I learn that I need to be healed before I am worthy of relationship? And again, I'm not just talking about romantic relationship. Where did I learn that I'm too much? Where did I learn that it's not worth it because I'm always going to get hurt anyway, or I'm always going to get left anyway? We know that trauma changes the structure and connectivity of certain areas of the brain. We know that trauma hardwires the nervous system to default to certain states. And this is a big deal. So instead of focusing all the things, all the energy on healing all the things, let's channel the energy. Remember, we've been talking about this for like over half of this series now. You have the ability to channel emotion and energy where you want it to go. So channel the energy towards cultivating safe reciprocal relationships where no matter where you are on your journey, you belong. Instead of waiting for the non-existent day when you outheal your humanness. Okay. Find the people that you can just be where you are right now, imperfect, unhealed, messy, figuring it out in your process, and you can still feel safe with those people. That's real community. Co-create a new normal for your relationships. If you have only one person, you just need one person, you literally can describe this type of safe reciprocal relationship and ask them if this is something they're needing to. Hey, I went to this workshop and she told us about reciprocity and open, honest communication and allowing our messiness to show up and like welcoming and celebrating all parts of us. Like, that's the kind of thing I'm looking for in my life. Is that the kind of thing you're looking for in your life? Cool. Can we try to figure that out together? It's amazing. Though my own inner circle has existed for many years and my relationship with David is over 22 years old, 2021 was really the year that I like leveled up in my, I mean, I've always been a good communicator. But I feel like something happened that year where I got really serious about communicating about the nervous system and using that language with my friends and talking more openly about awareness and consciousness. I started showing up in conversations with curiosity and noticing my own body, and I asked my closest relationships to learn with me. I practiced, we practiced. We do not always get it right. But the containers of these relationships are sacred as fuck to me because they are safe as fuck for me. Like, I know not everybody has what I've co-created with the people in my life, and I fiercely protect it and honor the sacredness of it because I have created safety for myself that was non-existent for most of my life. So, I will do whatever it takes to protect that. Vulnerability, transparency, and mask off authenticity is only weird and feels off limits because we've never seen it modeled. What we do see modeled, however, is unhealthy communication, very little vulnerability, people pleasing, assuming instead of asking, passive aggressiveness, fawning, boundarylessness, manipulation, control, censoring, and fear. All of these very normal ways of showing up in relationship are not working. Remember, we're not healing to go back to normal. All of that that I just listed is normal. Shitty communication is actually normal. Fawning and people pleasing is actually normal. They don't create thriving relationships. They end relationships or they keep us in toxic relationships way longer than is good for us. Normal doesn't always mean healthy. Some relationships are not going to withstand this type of authenticity and vulnerability because they are built on one or more person's ability to fawn and people please or stay silent or censor themselves or hold themselves back. I can promise you, if you're showing up in people pleasing in any of your relationships, the foundation of that relationship is built on your ability to people please. So the second you stop people pleasing, it crumbles, right? Because you literally killed off the part of you that they loved because it was easier. The relationships that welcome and practice this level of vulnerability will last. Do you want to know who your people are? That's your filter. We need to normalize vulnerability, honesty, integrity, and authenticity in relationship. And I hope that all of you can see through this and my Instagram account that vulnerability, honesty, integrity, and authenticity are like the bomb, like really the bomb. If you are starting a new relationship, a new friend, a new partnership, whatever, start with this type of communication and vulnerability from the beginning. If they can't handle it from the beginning, they're not going to be able to handle it a year from now. Okay. If you're navigating established relationships and the other person is interested in creating this safe reciprocal relationship with you, then start practicing this type of communication and vulnerability. Here are some examples of things that it's okay to say to people in your life as you're building these safe, reciprocal relationships. I have a tendency to self-abandon by fawning and people-pleasing. I'm working on setting boundaries. So if I come across as harsh, please know it's because I'm new at this and I'm learning. It's okay for you to tell me how my boundaries land with you. Doesn't mean I'm going to change them, right? But it's okay to be like, hey, I get your boundary, but like that came across like, it landed really harshly in my system. Can we talk about that? Right? That's an actual conversation that I've had with someone. This is also an actual conversation that I've had with someone. I can be really sensitive to nonverbal communication cues like body language and facial expression. I may need to ask for clarification if I get confused or triggered. Is that okay with you? That's vulnerable because that says I'm showing you this part of me that you might not like and that you might not be able to handle. But I'm trying to show it to you and navigate it in a way that honors both of us. Do you see how this honors me and it honors the other person? Nobody's dishonored in this. Another one, I tend to overgive in relationships and I let people emotionally dump on me because I believe that's what makes me a good friend. I'm working on this. Please ask me before you vent or dump and know that if I say no, it doesn't mean you can never share. Are you okay with navigating this on a case-by-case basis? I'm not always going to have the capacity for you to dump on me like you do sometimes. And I want to be able to say no and opt out of that when I need to. And that needs to be okay. And I need to know that you're not going to label me as a bad friend. I have a thing. This is part of my abandonment too. Anybody else have this thing where you send someone a text message asking a question or something? You get a red receipt, like they read it, but then they don't reply back for like hours or maybe even days. And the whole time in your head, you're like, fuck, what did I say? And you replay the last time the two of you were together, like a movie, and you try to figure out what did I say that pissed them off? Because that's why they're not responding to me right now. Anybody else do that, or is that just me? Okay. So I've learned how to text back. I totally understand if you need time to think about what I've asked. If you could acknowledge that you've heard or seen my request and that you're thinking about it, that would help me feel more secure. Do you know how vulnerable it is to tell somebody something like that? That feels really tender. And I'm risking somebody being like, oh my God, would you just stop being so sensitive already? Like, I'm totally risking that happening. But if someone in my inner circle were to respond to me with, oh my God, you're so sensitive, would you get over it already? I would be like, I don't know that you're in my inner circle if that's going to be your response to me. Like, it's really fucking valuable feedback. When you show up with this mask off authenticity and vulnerability in your integrity, and that isn't reciprocated multiple times, that's fucking valuable feedback. That's great data that you need to collect because that's telling you something about that relationship where maybe you're doing 80% of the work in that relationship. It's really okay to tell someone, have an anxious avoidant attachment. I actually said this. If I start to seem clingy and needy and then push you away, can you please let me know? I'm really working on this and I don't want to send you mixed signals because I love you. I'm realizing that I might always need a higher level of emotional support in intimate relationships. Can that be okay between us? And will you let me know if it's ever becoming too much for you? Then if somebody is like, no, I can't give you a higher level of emotional support, it's not okay if you let me, like, if I let you know that I'm not comfortable telling you that. Really valuable feedback for me, because I'm really only here for relationships that don't see my need for a higher level of emotional support as a problem. It's really okay to say, I would love to deepen our connection. Can I be vulnerable about this? Can I let you in to this like dark part of me that I try to keep hidden from everybody and trust that you can hold that with me? Again, really fucking valuable feedback if they can't. I don't expect that we'll have perfectly smooth relationship all the time, but repairing after ruptures is really important to me because I value you and this relationship. Are you open to repairing with me when we have a conflict? I am in a relationship with someone right now where last week we had a rupture. On Monday of this week, we attempted our first repair. It's the first major rupture I've had with this person, by the way, so it's unfamiliar for both of us. On Monday, we had our first attempt at repair. And when I shared that when he got up and walked out of the room, when we were in the middle of our conflict, he just left, didn't come back and say, hey, I needed some space, didn't text me later and say, hey, I needed to walk out of that because it was becoming too much for me. Can I take some space and call you tomorrow? Nothing for days. And when I finally did have that attempted repair conversation with him, and I said, hey, I know I interrupted you when you were talking to me, and I understand that that upset you. And I will try really hard not to interrupt you again because it's frustrating when I get interrupted too. But when you left the room and you didn't let me know that you needed space or how long you would be, or if I didn't know what to do. And like that felt like abandonment to me. And this person laughed. And now I am in the very serious, uncomfortable position of deciding if this is a relationship that I can continue at the same level of emotional intimacy that we're in, because I thought that we could. And now he's saying things like, I'm too much and I'm too intense sometimes. And he doesn't like talking about feelings because it feels like therapy and he doesn't like therapy. Like it's revealed some things that I didn't know were there for this person. And so now I have to reevaluate. Like, I'm sorry, but if you can't stay with me through a repair or at least communicate with words that you need a break and that you're coming back, you can't be in my inner circle. Sorry. I've worked too fucking hard to get to where I am to allow shit like that in my inner circle. It's been a massive test of my authenticity and also of, because it would be so easy. It would be so easy for me to go, oh, well, I have David and I have Honor and I have Mark and I have these other people in my life and they fit that need for me. So he can still be in my inner circle, even if he's not capable of this. Like it would be really easy for me to justify it that way. But I actually expect, like, if I'm going to show up vulnerable, honest, open, authentic, tender. And I expect that to be reciprocated. And if you can't reciprocate that, like, this doesn't work for me because I am worth relationships that put just as much into me as I put into them. Like, that's a massive, a lot of people would hear that and be like, oh my God, you're so selfish. Like, no, I'm not. I'm just too far along in my process at this point to allow that kind of bullshit into my life whenever I have all these other amazing relationships. That's not a problem. You know? Do you see how you are never going to accidentally stumble in this into this kind of relationship? It has to be co-created. Each person has to be a willing, consenting participant in safety and reciprocity. So don't reduce your lifestyle inflammation because it's a necessary part of the healing journey, even though it is. reduce it so that you can open up room in your life to live and thrive. That's the whole point. Not to fix something, but to open up space in your life to live and thrive. So, where can you free up time? What do you need to say no to so that you can say yes to something that lights you up or makes your heart feel happy? Where are you still in a fixing energy and how can you bring in support? Reducing lifestyle inflammation may require you to make some big, scary changes. Let me tell you something. It is fucking terrifying for me to imagine telling this person, I can't be as close to you as we've been because after the way you handled this, I don't trust that you're emotionally safe for me anymore. That's terrifying to imagine. It's also terrifying because he's the partner of one of my other really good friends who is safe for me. So it's like, how can I be emotionally intimate with one of you, but not with the other when we spend so much time together? You know? It's a big, scary change. I've had clients who have left jobs, who have left relationships, who have picked up their lives and moved, who have made some really big, scary decisions so that they could follow what felt authentic and spacious for them. And also reduce the lifestyle inflammation of the healing journey. You don't have to be a healing journey perfectionist and have healing journey anxiety. You can choose something else. So remember in the Overcoming Health Anxiety workshop, I said, or we talked about changing the energy with which we approach our healthcare and having acceptance of whatever's happening and cultivating self-trust. We've come full circle back to that. So, just like I told you, that symptoms aren't the root cause of health anxiety, nervous system dysregulation and triggers aren't the cause of healing journey anxiety. Are you hypervigilant or hypersensitive about the state of your nervous system? Do you catastrophize when you've been triggered or if you've been dysregulated for a longer period of time? Like you make it mean something about you or you imagine all these worst case scenarios. Does it mean you're crashing? Does it mean you're flaring? Does it mean the future is probably bleak and there's a big struggle ahead of you? Do you obsess and worry about healing your nervous system and trauma? Are you trying to control and micromanage your nervous system or the amount of time it's taking? I had a coaching call with somebody yesterday, and their whole energy was like, I'm in the healing profession and it shouldn't take this long. Like that was really their whole vibe. We had to unpack that. Are you trying to heal perfectly? What would it take to let all that go and just live your fucking life? Now we'll talk about fixing versus supporting. So there's a different energy in fixing and supporting, right? Fixing implies something is broken. Fixing has this energy of like more is better. Like I definitely remember whenever I was on the hamster wheel of wellness, it was like, ooh, I need this modality and I need this diet and I need this supplement and this supplement and this supplement and this practitioner and this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing, and this thing, right? That's because I was in a fixing energy. So more is better. Like if a little bit's good, more is probably better, right? That's fixing energy. It has a grabby, urgent energy and it's like whack-a-mole energy. Are you guys in Europe familiar with whack-a-mole? Right? Okay, so it's this game at arcades that has these like there's this padded sort of mallet that you hit it with, and there's like five or six of these like things that like you put your quarter in or whatever, and then they randomly start popping up out of these holes, and you use the padded hammer to like hit them back down. That's what fixing energy is, right? It's like as soon as something pops up, you're like, oh, I need something to fix it. Oh, here's something else. Oh, I need something to fix it, right? Okay. Supporting energy, however, acknowledges nothing is broken. It just needs extra care. Like, makes sense why this is happening. It just needs some extra support. There's more of an energy of less is more because the healing journey is a mostly subtractive process. It's a more grounded, stabilized energy. At least it is in my body. So here's some curiosity questions if you want to unpack fixing and supporting energy. Who am I if I'm not fixing or healing something? Am I in an energy of fixing? Maybe you have a fixer kid on your bus. Like maybe you have a kid who's the fixer. How could I integrate that part so I can support myself in a grounded, non-urgent, accepting way? if there was nothing to fix and only mindfulness about how I'm supporting myself, what would I love to do with my time, energy, and money? Is there anything about an energy of fixing that feels authentic for me? What exactly am I trying to fix? What could it look like to support myself through this instead of fixing? Is the energy of fixing actually calling me to support myself? Can I trust myself to support myself? Where do I feel any fear or doubt or resistance in my body? If you could imagine coming out of fixing energy and surrendering into support energy, where's the resistance in that transition? So, in the Health Anxiety Workshop, I asked you, could you be open to the possibility that your relationship with your body could be based in pleasure or at least have room for pleasure alongside pain? Focusing on pain is dysregulating to your nervous system and elevates the stress hormone cortisol, leading to inflammation, a weaker immune system, sleep issues, hormone imbalances, and weight gain. Orienting to pleasure reduces dysregulation, which reduces cortisol, and the body can return to homeostasis. So remember, we have been conditioned to focus on what's bad, on what's wrong, on what needs to be fixed, on whatever the problem is. Focus on that stuff keeps us distracted from pleasure and following our desires. It also keeps us from living authentically because no one's authentic self is in fix-it mode as an inherent state. Repatterning happens when we change our personal relationship to pleasure. It also happens when we experience pleasure inside the container of safe reciprocal relationships. And you create safety and connection when you play and have fun and do life with your people. Just do life with your people. Here's what doing life together looks like with me and my people. We laugh a lot. We make a lot of good memories together. We cook and eat a lot together. Like most of our lives are focused around food, actually. We help one another a lot. Like I had harvested a bunch of, I don't know what it's called over in Europe, but there's a plant called Guelder Rose. It's also called Highbush Cranberry. The bark of the plant is where is called cramp bark, and it's made into a tincture for like menstrual cramps. So I had harvested a bunch of sticks from some Guelder Rose and had it like sitting in my on my porch waiting because you have to like scrape the outer bark off and then you use the inner bark as the tincture. And so I just asked my friend Honor to come over on Tuesday and we divided it and we got all the bark stripped and tinctured. And I've got 2 quarts of cramp bark tincture like steeping now. I don't think I would have done that if I had to do it by myself. Like I needed the co-regulation of another person to do that with me. So like then whenever she has like firewood that needs to be stacked, she calls me and David and me go show up and we stack her firewood. And then the next time she'll come over and she and her partner will make me dinner. And then the next time I'll go to their house and I'll make them dinner. It's just, we're not ever keeping track, right? We're just like, oh yeah, it's my turn to help you over here. It's your turn to help me over here. Like we're just helping one another. We spend holidays together, and we repair our ruptures together. Honor and I have gone through many conflict cycles with rupture and repair. So we know how to do it really well. It's not scary in that friendship to have a rupture because we've had enough emotionally corrective experiences with successful repairs. So this is how you do life with people. You have to spend time in each other's homes. You have to have regular meals together. We have family dinner every Monday with Honor and Jeffrey and every Friday with our friends Mark and Ellen. We share food, tools, supplies. We hold space for each other. A couple weeks ago, my friend Mark sent a text of a picture. One of his chickens had gotten attacked by the neighbor's dogs. He was wondering what to do about it. I was from the photo, it didn't look like the wound was that bad. And I was like, you know, we might just be able to clean it and like put a couple stitches in it and she might be fine. So I loaded up needle, thread, Neosporin. We had some leftover amoxicillin from like years ago. I was like, this chicken's probably gonna need antibiotics. So I like chat GPT'd how to dose a chicken with amoxicillin. Like, so I get all this stuff together and I go over to Mark's place and we take a look at the chicken and it was like, oh shit, it's way worse than what he thought. It was way worse than what we thought. And we decided she's not gonna make it. There's no way we can sew this up. Like, she's probably gonna get an infection. That's gonna kill her. So he had to kill the chicken, like, put it out of its misery. And I held the chicken down while he cut its head off. Like, this is the level of like shit that I'm doing with these people. Like, that is not the kind of experience I would wanna have to do by myself, right? Like, I don't wanna cut a fucking chicken's head off by myself or figure out if it's gonna live or die. I want somebody there co-regulating with me who can help me make that decision. We help with childcare and we invest in each other's kids. We do chores together. I get help pulling weeds. They get help stacking firewood. We repot plants. Like, we do all kinds of chores together. We ride along with each other when we have the time and a friend has an appointment or errands because we live so far from the city that, like, if Honor has therapy in the city or something and I have a free day, I'm not working. She might be like, hey, you want to ride along with me and keep me company while I go to my therapy appointment? And then we spend time together that way. We also celebrate a lot of milestones together. In community like this, natural opportunities arise to build safety and intimacy. The more time you spend with people and the longer you know people, the more inevitable it is that you're going to face conflict in those relationships eventually. Disagreement happens. Schedules don't work out sometimes. There's miscommunications. We get sick. We go on vacation. We have ebbs and flows of time together. But every time a rupture happens, whether it's big or small, we begin to learn through repair that love stays. Okay, I went through this big, scary rupture that always makes me feel like I'm going to get abandoned, but we went through it. We got through it. I'm safe in this relationship. I didn't get abandoned. Tally mark in the emotionally corrective experience column. You know, and then you do it again, another tally mark in the emotionally corrective experience column. Yeah, this begins to slowly heal the fears of abandonment, and it allows whatever your adaptive patterns are. For me, it's hypervigilance and fawning and sensitivity. Everything just kind of settles and it goes down naturally because over time, with enough repetition of rupture and repair, you get through that cycle and you're like, oh, okay. I can trust that we can figure this out. I can trust that I can share my feelings with this person and that they can share their feelings with me and that we can figure this out. It's such a beautiful, it's painful, but it's so beautiful. All right, so I'll share some of my people with you. This is my platonic life partner. Her name is Honor. This is her daughter, Alma. This is an old picture. Alma's actually 11 now. David is Alma's favorite person on the planet. She's like always hanging on to him like that. Honor is a projector like me, crazy enough. So that's Honor. These are our friends, Mark and Ellen. This weird picture is we had a bunch of slugs in our garden and we had them over and we all like went outside with cans and picked slugs off of everything together. Whoops. Shit. Damn. How did I do that? There we go. This is Honor's partner, Jeffrey, one of my people. And of course, there's David. He's always my people. So when the energy of fixing comes in and the health and healing perfectionism tries to take over, and all the voices in your head are saying you haven't made progress and you aren't healing fast enough, and blah, 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 blah. Remind yourself that temporary regressions are normal. You are still a human being with a brain and a nervous system that is prone to getting triggered at times. You are living in awareness. You are taking responsibility for yourself. Our friend Pete says, those who stick with a long-term recovery process are often rewarded with emotional intelligence far beyond the norm. This is somewhat paradoxical, as survivors of childhood trauma are initially injured more grievously than their emotional nature in their emotional natures than those in the general population. The silver lining in this, however, is that many of us were forced to consciously address our suffering because our wounding was so much more severe. Those who work on an effective recovery program not only recover significantly from emotional damage, but also evolve out of the emotional impoverishment of general society. Anybody feel like you were forced to consciously address your suffering because your wounding was so severe? Anybody feel that way? Yeah, I definitely do. Perhaps the greatest reward of improved emotional intelligence is seen in a greater capacity for deeper intimacy. Intimacy is greatly enhanced when two people dialogue about all aspects of their existence. This is especially true when they transcend taboos against full emotional communication. Feelings of love, appreciation, and gratitude are naturally enhanced when we reciprocally show our full selves, confident or afraid, loving or alienated, proud or embarrassed. What an incredible achievement it is when any two of us create such an authentic and supportive relationship. Many of the most intimate relationships that I have seen are between people who have done a great deal of freeing themselves from the negative legacies of their upbringings. Embodying our authentic selves in connection with others' authentic selves is why we feel without fear. It's the entire point. It's the entire point of why we work on our nervous systems. It's the entire point of why we learn to communicate. It's the entire point of all of it. It's to embody your authentic self and to be in relationships with people who are also embodied in their authenticity and to create that safety and connection together. That's the entire point. All right. That's it. We'll take another break. Let's just do another 5 minutes. That's easy. So come back at 5 after the hour, and the floor will be open for Q&A.